Hello, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Thanks for joining Ray and me for another edition presenting the Führer's after-dinner private conversations. I emphasize private, as written down in shorthand by attorney Heinrich Heim with the permission of Hitler. Today is August 21st, 2014, and this is edition 24. I'm Carolyn Yeager. And I'm waiting for Ray's phone call because once again tonight he has to call in on the telephone. So I'm watching here where the call will appear. Here it is. Good.
Hello there.
Hello there, Ray. How are you?
All right. We're connected. How are you?
Yeah, we're connected and we're on the air.
Okay.
I'm just fine. And I was just... I was just introducing the very beginning of the show, and I wanted to wait until you got on here before I continued because I wanted to tell you and the listeners that tonight I have a letter from a listener and a donor to share. I've never mentioned contributors on this program, but tonight I'm going to. As some of you may be aware, I make it a practice to thank on the air those dear people who send donations, which always come out to be enough to cover my operating expenses. A few weeks ago, I commented that I missed Jaime Schwartz of Brooklyn, New York, Florida, and Tel Aviv, who had been mailing something to my P.O. box every month for about a year. I can't say exactly when it started, but approximately that or longer. And I realized that I hadn't gotten anything from him for a while, and so on the air I questioned jokingly whether he had deserted me, and if so, it was all right because I appreciated all that he had already done. Well, lo and behold, the other day he appears in my P.O. box, and I was so glad to hear from him, and he actually sent me a handwritten letter this time, which I'm going to read now since he mentions both Table Talk and you, Ray. So here's the letter. It's funny. Dear Ms. Yeager, I'm sending this letter to inform you that I haven't deserted you or our cause. See, he heard me say that on the on the air. While visiting the Carolinas in June, I was taken ill with a strep infection in my lungs that required surgery. Wow, I felt bad about that. He wrote this on August 13th. So about a week ago, I'm a little slow in getting things from my post office box. And he says, I had to spend the entire month of July following my German-descended doctor's orders that Mrs. Schwartz strictly enforced that I lift nothing heavier than a spoon or fork, and I was practically bedridden. During my convalescing, I particularly enjoyed listening to Table Talk while eating Mrs. Schwartz's kosher chicken soup. So please thank Mr. Goodman for me. I have now made a full recovery and am prepared to go stormtrooping once again. Enclosed are my dues. This is what I think is funny. Enclosed are my dues for June, July, and August with a $10 late fee. Wishing you well and continue your great work, Jaime Schwartz from Brooklyn. He gives another name there, but it's not Jaime. But I like Jaime Schwartz from Brooklyn, so we'll stick with that. So I just
All right.
I was real happy with that.
Good, yeah.
And he likes you too, Ray.
Good deal. I appreciate that.
Well, you
Very
know,
nice.
I've gotten a lot of comments from people that enjoy you on the program, and I know they're happy that you're doing the reading and not me. I can just tell that.
Well, it's much appreciated, and I think, hey, it's teamwork. It's all about teamwork, and I think you and I make a pretty decent team on pulling off this project.
Well, I think so, too. So do all our listeners, too, the ones who
Good.
Like the show. So here we go. We're starting another week here, and I'm just going to give a timeline for January 28th, which is where we're starting, and it is not too important. Well, I think I mentioned it before, but I was a little ahead of myself. But here again, January 28th, Brazil breaks off relations with the Axis powers. Yeah, we talked about that.
Yes.
Last week. So, okay, it's all yours now. Until
okay,
I break 20, in.
All righty. 28th of January, 1942, midday. Special guests are Field Marshal Milch and the airmen Jashanik and Galland. When one
now,
reflects
I've got
that,
I've got some information about these guests here.
Good.
You know, people should know that Milch is, I can't think of his first name now, but he's was number two under Göring in the Luftwaffe. So, and he's got two pilots there with him. You said Jashanik. I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm saying Jashanik.
I would call it, Jashanik.
Yeah, I don't know if that's right or not. I didn't check the pronunciation. But he was a pilot, but then he had become chief of general staff of the Luftwaffe, and he was very high up. His first name was Hans. But tragically, things didn't go so well for him, and he committed suicide in 1943. I'm not going to go into the details. And then Adolf Galland was a real famous pilot ace. But I was reading all about him today. I found out he wrote a memoir, and I want to get that. I want to read it. He was often critical of Hitler's decisions concerning the Luftwaffe, and some of this had to do with Göring, too. And I just know that there's so much controversy about decisions that were made and about the Luftwaffe. And the Luftwaffe really wasn't able to come through in so much of the war. In the beginning, it was doing great, but then it was a disappointment in many ways. So you'll probably never get to the bottom of it, and making decisions like this is not easy. But anyway, that's who's there on this very, very short little nothing here for this day. Maybe he was so busy talking to these people that they didn't take much down.
Very little, but it's rather interesting in the statement. He says, when one reflects that Frederick the Great held out against forces 12 times greater than his, one gets the impression what a grand fellow he must have been. This time, it's we who have the supremacy. I'm really quite ashamed of it. And
well, how do
that's
you take
all of
that?
That?
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering if the word ashamed should have been embarrassed, because I thought, why would he be ashamed of the supremacy there against the opponent?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a statement. I mean, I just couldn't reconcile anything in my mind that made it make sense. And unless he was embarrassed that, you know, that at that particular time his German forces held the upper hand in much of the combat.
Well. But it was already, they were already having trouble because of the cold weather, trouble with Stalingrad and Moscow. I don't know if it's Stalingrad yet, but I figured that what he meant was that Frederick the Great, who he admires so much, held out against forces 12 times greater than his. Wow, that's really something. And so he's a bit, like you say, embarrassed or ashamed that he's not doing as well.
Yeah, that's a better. That's a good take. That makes sense.
Yeah. It's just
okay,
kind
moving
of a throwaway
on.
Thing. You know, it's not all that important, really.
Right. The night of 28th, 29th January 1942.
Yeah, and now here, people have told me that they appreciate the timeline information,
mm-hmm.
So I'm going
sure.
ahead with it all, even though sometimes it doesn't seem to applicable to me, but on the 29th, Rommel enters Benghazi and Benghazi, Libya, in his drive east. For the next few months, the two sides will rest and rearm. Well, you know, this is the way Wikipedia puts it. Okay, now I won't interrupt for quite a while.
Okay, the Fuhrer says, do you know what caused the downfall of the ancient world? The ruling class had become rich and urbanized. From then on, it had been inspired by the wish to ensure for its heirs a life free from care. It's a state of mind that entails the following corollary. The more heirs there are, the less each one of them receives. Hence the limitation of births. The power of each family depended to some extent on the number of slaves it possessed. Thus there grew up the plebs, which was driven to multiplication, faced by a patrician class, which was shrinking. The day when Christianity abolished the frontier that had hitherto separated the two classes, the Roman patriciate found itself submerged in the resulting mass. It's the fall in the birth rate that's at the bottom of everything. France, with its two children families, is doomed to stagnation, and its situation can only get worse. The products of French industry do not lack quality, but the danger for France is that the spirit of routine may triumph over the generative impulses of progress. It's the feeding bottle that will save us. Even if this war costs us 250,000 dead and 100,000 disabled, these losses are already made good by the increase in births in Germany since our seizure of power. They will be paid for several times over by our colonization in the East. The population of German blood will multiply itself richly. I would regard it as a crime to have sacrificed the lives of German soldiers simply for the conquest of natural riches to be exploited in capitalist style. According to the laws of nature, the soil belongs to him who conquers it. The fact of having children who want to live, the fact that our people is bursting out of its cramped frontiers, these justify all our claims on the eastern spaces. The overflow of our birth rate will give us our chance. Overpopulation compels a people to look out for itself. There's no risk of our remaining fixed at our present level. Necessity will force us to be always at the head of progress. All life is paid for with blood. If a man doesn't like this notion of life, I advise him to renounce life altogether, for it proves he's not suited for the struggle. In any case, on the margin of this continual struggle, there's so much pleasure in living. So why be sad at what is so and could not be otherwise? The creative forces make their home in the bosom of the optimist, but faith is at the bottom of everything.
Well, do you think that's a good justification for seeking more territory, as he's saying it is?
Yeah, an exploding population. Germany, inside its borders, was already quite cramped with its 65 million or so people. and there was going to be a natural expansion for territory.
That's right. And you know what? If people, like he's talking about the French, are not expanding and are having small families, then they don't have that will to live that Hitler values so much, you know, that, mm-hmm. that inner strength that says, you know, we're going to live, we're going to make it work for us. And so if they weren't actually taking France, but if, you know, you have to fight for what you have, and you can't just sit there necessarily saying, well, this has been ours for such and such amount of time or whatever, or
sure.
We're here, because if you're not doing anything to earn it and deserve it and to make it yours, then somebody can come along and says, we need this, you know, and this, mm-hmm. there again you have the survival of the fittest, which has fallen into such disfavor among, you know, liberals and so on in our mm-hmm. way of thinking today. But I think, you know, I mean, I think he makes a pretty good case there.
I do too. I mean, he's talking about a stable or particularly a declining population that will stagnate and die on the vine, and that's why he says all life is paid for with blood. And if you have a growing nation that is depending on food from outside its own nation, it's got to expand or die and cut back. And so I think he explained that pretty well.
And I like his line, it's the feeding bottle that will save us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, meaning so, agriculture.
No, the feeding bottle, the for the infants, the newborn.
Oh,
having
yeah,
a lot
yeah.
Of, that's what
right.
I thought, having a lot of children, you know, and
that's
what you mean by that, pretty sure. That's a clever way to put it. However, it was working at that time. There was a lot of new children being born, starting in 1939 especially.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so another timeline for January 30th, Hitler speaks at the Berlin Sports Palace, and that was one of his big speeches in 42. And Wikipedia says he threatens the Jews of the world with annihilation. This may be where he made that famous statement that if the Jews try to destroy us with war, they are the ones who will be destroyed in the end, something like that, which is not threatening the Jews with annihilation. But, and then they say that he was talking about the weather and the effect on the Soviet offensive, their offensive in the Soviet Union, and how they had a big setback because of the weather. So they say he's blaming it on the weather, but you know, it was a big part of it.
Sure.
The weather. So that took place on the 30th of January, 42.
Okay, and then that's our next step, the 30th of January, 1942, midday. Special guest, is that Dr. Lee or Lay, Carolyn?
Dr. Lay, and I'll just go ahead with these people here. Dr. Lay was head of the National Labor Service. He's a very important man. And, of course, Heydrich is Reinhard Heydrich. And Dr. Weber, I couldn't find out anything about him, actually, because there's no first name. And Benno von Arnold is one of the founders of he was like an artist person, one of the founders of the Union of National Socialist Stage and Movie Artists, which was renamed Fellowship of German Artists after Hitler's rise to power in 1933. And this guy... He not only designed stage and movie sets and stuff, and he designed clothing, he designed lots of things, and I guess he was a pretty good National Socialist.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a kind of a strange group that are there. I don't know what they have
in
common.
Yeah, it is. Pretty wild.
I don't know if they have anything in common. They just all happen to be there on this
day. Yeah. Provided this day. You can bet it provided interesting company, though.
Yeah.
As an orator, my most dangerous opponent was Ballerstedt. What a feat it was to hold my own against him. His father was a Hessian. His mother was from Lorraine. He was a diabolical dialectician. To give his hearers the impression that he agreed with them, he began with a eulogy of the Prussians. I've been condemned several times for accusing this man of treason, and yet he was, in fact, sold to the French. Finally, I got 3 months imprisonment for breaking up one of his meetings. In the reasons adduced for the verdict, the point of view was put in evidence that the fact of regarding Ballerstedt's policy as treason toward the Reich did not correspond to any objective reality. The court recorded that this was simply a matter of a policy which I personally regarded as treason.
Now, this goes back pretty far, right?
Mm-hmm, it does.
He's talking about the past here.
Yes.
The
early days of the party.
Mm-hmm.
The experience I've had in the course of my life of the stupidity of lawyers has resulted in these people's being definitely classified, in my view. They're the people who used to burn witches. Originally, I used to think it was an idiosyncrasy of Dietrich Eckert's continually to attack lawyers. He used to say that the mere fact of wanting to be a lawyer came from a mental deficiency. Alternatively, he used to explain the mental deficiency came of being a lawyer. It was Eckert who asked the advocate Zichwitz, on whom some dignity had just been conferred, was it a reward you... Was it to reward you for having lost all your cases? My first long term of imprisonment was at Stadelheim. as he led me into my cell, the warder amiably pointing out to me that a number of celebrated men had lived there before, Ludwig Thoma, for example, and likewise Kurt Eisner. Kriebel continually complained at Landsberg. During the first days, it was because of the heating. He spent his time finding fault with the warders. One day, he had the idea of sending for the prison regulations, which dated from 1860. He read them attentively and discovered that the prisoners were entitled notably to a chest of drawers. Another day, it was revealed to him that the reverend priests were obliged to visit the prisoners, and he complained of not yet having seen the shadow of a cassock. The Mufti, M-U-F-T-I, this was the name we gave the director of the prison, was at his wit's end and came and consulted me. Might Colonel Kriebel be a war wounded? What do you mean by that? He's raving mad. Well, I think he once had malaria, so he should be treated with care. I think that would be the proper course. We must present Haha as one of the greatest men who've ever lived, but on condition that he leaves the checks, a legacy that will destroy them forever. We mustn't hesitate to make at least as much of him as King Wenceslas, so that until the end of time, all the cowards can complain of him. His successor, it doesn't matter who, as long as he's a lecher, we'll always get along better with cads than with men of character. We'll
now,
settle the checks.
You go ahead and finish this.
We'll settle the checks, Hash, if we follow a consistent policy with them, without letting this policy be influenced by accidents of persons. Since the Battle of the White Mountains in 1620 and until 1867, the Austrian state pursued this policy towards the Czechs. Thus, the Czechs ended in being ashamed of speaking their own tongue. A great part of the Czechs are of Germanic origin, and it's not impossible to re-Germanize them.
Well, what do you think of that, Ray?
I thought that was an interesting passage because, in a way, he's slapping at the present-day Czech and its leadership, and he's saying that in the past, the Austrians made such a deal of their own country that the Czechs kind of even, as he said, were ashamed to speak their own language, and so they obviously took up German. And this policy was good for 250 years that the Austrian state pursued that policy toward those Czechs. And then they had changed and turned around after that 1867 into a kind of a nationalist anti-German position. That's kind of how I took it. So he says these people like the Czech leader, Haha, we've got to extol him as one of the greatest men who ever lived, but on the condition that he leaves the Czechs a legacy that will destroy them forever. And I think, to me, that means them becoming quite nationalistic and antagonistic towards Germany was going to destroy them because it was a foolish thing on the Czechs' part. That's kind of what it meant to me.
Okay. Well, I Hitler has a history of from his time in Vienna of disliking the Czech minority in Austria-Hungary and the Czech minority in the Austrian part, let's say. The Czech minority was the largest minority, so they are very active, very vocal. There are a lot of them in the parliament and so on, and he visited the parliament and saw what was going on there, and he said they were all speaking, everybody was speaking in their own language in Parliament, so some people didn't understand other people, and they would just ignore what was being said. Just thought it was a total mess.
That's right.
So he had a bad opinion of the Czechs from that, and I think when he says the legacy that will destroy them forever, it's just another example of using that kind of language but not meaning it literally at all. You know, he just means it to destroy that idea that the Czechs have, that they're such troublemakers.
Yeah, that, you know, well, to me, he's saying that they're going to destroy themselves with their behavior. Because, you know, in previous lessons on this, Carolyn, he's said things that were complimentary or admiring about the Czechs. You know, even when he was, I say, irked or whatever about them, he said the thing about them, those people, they will work. And
well, he's saying that even here.
Yeah.
He's ending up with it, you know. He's saying there, it's not impossible to re-Germanize them. That's good. That's good in his mind. He thinks the Czechs are of Germanic origin, a great part of them. So he thinks they can, that Germany and the Czechs can get along just fine. But it has to be under German domination, you might say. Under German rule, like it was in Austria all that time, as he always said. You know, the Germans were the bureaucrats and they ran the state. And everybody went along with them pretty well. And the Czechs even wanted to speak German for that reason, although sometimes it brought out that the language was a different language was a problem. But he's always showing, these two sides to the Czechs. He likes the Czechs, but he doesn't want them to be antagonistic, and he wants them to kind of fall under the German identity, you might say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and that comment where he says, for those 250 years, thus the Czechs ended in being ashamed of speaking their own tongue. Well, when they adopted the German language, you know, there's something about that common language in a people that is unifying. And then when it kind of shifted the other way and the Czechs kind of went that way, it was... you know, in Hitler's way of thinking, very divisive, and so just let them sink in their own juices is what he was kind of saying.
Yeah, okay. From his point of view, he doesn't have a bad attitude to the Czechs, but from the Czech nationalists, it's a bad attitude.
Right.
All right.
Okay, moving on to the last day of January.
Oh, yeah, I've got another timeline. January 31st. The Japanese take the port of Mula Mien, Burma. They now threaten Rangoon as well as Singapore. And on the Eastern Front, Wikipedia wants us to know that the Germans are in retreat at several points. Everything here is always from the Allied point of view and making them look good. And says that the last organized Allied forces leaving Malaya, ending the 54-day battle. Allied forces, that would be probably mostly British. Where is Malaya? That's in that's
Southeast Asia.
Yeah, right. I know that. But exactly. Well, anyway, there was a 54-day battle, and I guess, again, the Japanese are just winning here still.
They're pushing their way southward towards Australia.
Mm-hmm. But the Germans are finding too tough a resistance in Russia at this point, starting to. Already, you know, it seems like the war just started. But
that's right.
It's been six or seven months, and it's already turning around. That first winter really did a job.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, the German colonies suffered from a lack of skilled labor. That explains why there was no possibility for big investments. Yet they were territories populated by 3 or 4 million natives. In India, the English invested huge sums, railways and other methods of transport, factories and port installations. If each of 380 million Indians merely buys a reel of cotton every year, imagine what a volume of business that adds up to. Cotton goods were at first manufactured in England. It's only little by little that factories were built in India herself. It's the capitalist notion of business that led to that result. People thought that the saving on transport costs and the employment of less expensive labor would increase the margin of profit. For a capitalist, it would be a crime to waste such a crumb. What was the result? Today, England has an army of 2.5 million unemployed. I'll just comment right there on that, Carolyn. That is exactly what he's describing there is exactly the NAFTA and all that involving the United States, those free trade, and it has sunk the nation that once led the world in the production of various products, all in the name of profit, and cost its own country tons of unemployed people. That is a perfect example that he cites right there about England sending factories over to India and paying that cheap labor and then having thus a higher net profit on their goods. In actuality, the capitalist outlook was sinking Britain.
Yeah, it was only good for those companies.
Yeah, yeah.
For those big companies. And I have exactly the same note written down, Ray, that this is what happened in the U.S. with outsourcing, just to take it all in under one word. That's what we did, and that's why we now have no good employment for our people, for the most part.
Oh, yeah. There are in Great Britain more than 400 taxpayers with a yearly income of more than £1 million. In Germany, only the Kaiser, Hinkel von Donnersmarck, and Thurn and Taxis had incomes of 3 to 4 million marks. A man who had a fortune of 1 million marks was already regarded as a nabob. But for the First World War, the English would have gone on enjoying the blessings of the Victorian age. What is Libya to Great Britain? Another desert. Every war comes to an end at the moment when one of the belligerents decides he must cut costs. In this war, it's the English who will throw in the sponge. Strategic successes can make no difference to the empire's precarious situation. England can continue to be viable only if she links herself to the continent. She must be able to defend her imperial interest within the framework of a continental organization. It's only on this condition that she'll keep her empire. But nothing's more difficult than to come down from a pedestal. Thus, Austria clung until 1866 to the fiction of supremacy, and then it took her another 70 years to learn from the facts. British military prestige has been reestablished by the conquest of Benghazi. It was the psychological moment to put an end to the war, but Churchill had Russia at the back of his mind, and he didn't see that if Russia were to triumph over Germany, Europe would at once come under the hegemony of a great power. Too many Jews had an interest in seeing events take this turn. The Jew is so stupid that he himself saws through the branch on which he's sitting. In 1919, a Jewish wrote in the Bayrischer... wrote in the Bayrischer Courier, "What Eisner's doing now will recoil upon our heads. A case of rare foresight." If I may comment on that right there, in 1919, Kurt Eisner was one of the leading red politicians that was encouraging Bolshevism, and along with the Spartacist movement. Rosa Luxemburg was part of that criminal gang trying to subvert Germany to a communist nation. And that's when he says that Jewish wrote in that newspaper, "What Eisner's doing right now will recoil upon our heads. A rare case of foresight. So that's what that was about.
Yeah.
France remains hostile to us. She contains, in addition to her Nordic blood, a blood that will always be foreign to us. In addition to Paris, which is more spontaneous in its reactions, she has the clerical and Masonic South. In imitation of Talleyrand in 1815, the French try to profit by our moments of weakness to get the greatest possible advantage from the situation. But with me, they won't succeed in their plans. There's no possibility of our making any pact with the French before we've definitely ensured our power. Our policy at this moment may consist in cleverly playing off one lot against the other. There must be two Frances. Thus, the French who have compromised themselves with us will find it to their own interest that we should remain in Paris as long as possible. But our best protection against France will be for us to maintain a strong friendship lasting for centuries with Italy. Unlike France, Italy is inspired by political notions that are close to ours. I was thinking of the Italian delegation I received yesterday. I met men who have rulers' qualities, such as are very much to my taste. What handsome individuals and what a resolute air. Those are men who could play a part at the top level.
Well, before we go on, Ray, you know, this last paragraph you read is pretty interesting. I'm not real clear about it, but he is saying that one thing I wondered about the Masonic South, he's talking about the foreign element in France, and you find it in Paris, but also in the clerical and Masonic South. And so I guess he's talking about Freemasons.
Yes.
There, and he doesn't like either the clerical institute, the clerical strength there, and he doesn't like the Masonic strength there, which is some people would think would be enemies amongst themselves, but maybe he doesn't see it that way. And then he says that those French who have compromised themselves with Germany, that have embraced the German occupation, a lot of them did.
Yes.
They're going to find it. They're going to want us to stay there. They don't want us to leave, and then they're going to have to face what the others are going to do to them. So I guess he's saying that this is good for us, for Germany, that there's a number of French there who have thrown in their lot with the Germans, and therefore will want the Germans to stay. It's just a natural thing, but it's interesting that that he brings that out. And then he wants to dismiss the French and build up the Italians, which is what he's going to do right now. Which you started with.
Yeah, and you know his remark about Paris more spontaneous in its reactions. She has the clerical and Masonic South. The implication there is, of course, the Masonic or the Masons are supposedly totally controlled and directed by the Jews. And, of course, the clerics are usually hand-in-hand with that sort. So I think that's what he was referencing there. But, you know, one part of France, you're right, Vichy France, whatever, that had a that supported Germany, and were got along with them fine. You know, they were neutral if they weren't openly in support of them, and they were neutral. And a lot of that, whenever the D-Day came, and a lot of France was bombed and smashed, there were many, many Frenchmen who complained and said we were much better off when the Germans were here. They didn't tear our country to pieces, and they very much resented the fact that Germany had been pushed out. Okay. The fascists paid with their blood much more than we did. The story of the conquest of power in Italy is an heroic epic. It always warms my heart to think of it. I can understand their emotion when they once more live through the time of the March on Rome. Why should such men suddenly become worthless as soldiers? It's quite simply because they lack a command. The Italian people is idealistic, but the cadres of the Italian army are reactionary. It's strange
how... Now, what does the cadres mean? What does he mean by cadres? Because I would think you'd say the officers, or maybe.
Yeah, the officer corps. It's the group of elite that run the military.
What I was thinking, but I didn't know that would be the word for that would be cadres, but...
Yeah.
I think that's what he means, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's strange how throughout the last 100 years, our two peoples have had perceptibly the same destiny. First of all, the wars for unity, then the fact that each was cheated of its rights, then more recently the two sister revolutions that knew nothing of one another. It was in 1921 that I first heard fascism mentioned. The SA was born in 1920 without my having the least idea of what was going on in Italy. Italy developed in a manner at which I was the first to be surprised. I could see fairly clearly the orientation that it would be proper to give the party, but I had no ideas concerning paramilitary organizations. I began by creating a service to keep order, and it was only after the bloody brawls of 1920 that I gave these troops the name Sturm Ableton SA as a reward for their behavior. I had taught them the technique of concentrating their efforts on limited objectives and at meetings to attack the opponent table by table, but it was confined to that. When the brassard proved no longer sufficient, I equipped them with a specially designed cap. That was after Coburg. The skier's cap didn't cost much. It was all done in a very empirical manner. Nothing of that sort was thought out in advance. The SS started with formations of 7 or 8 men. In these, we gathered the tough ones. Things developed spontaneously and subsequently acquired a speed comparable to that of developments in Italy. The Duce himself has told me that at the moment when he undertook the struggle against Bolshevism, he didn't know exactly where he was going. What crowns these parallel destinies is that today we are fighting side by side against the same powers and against the same personages. At the same period, the Duce and I were both working in the building trade. This explains that there is also a bond between us on the purely human level. I have a deep friendship for this extraordinary man. From the cultural point of view, we are most closely linked with the Italians than with any other people. The art of northern Italy is something we have in common with them, nothing but pure Germans. The objectionable Italian type is found only in the South, and not everywhere, even there. We also have this type in our own country. When I think of them, Vienna, Otterkring, Munich, Giesing, Berlin, Pankow, if I compare the two types, that of these degenerate Italians and our type, I find it very difficult to say which of the two is the more antipathetic. There is a difference between day and night, between the genuine fascist and the others. Those society people with whom we are compelled to associate, that cosmopolitan world, they're more or less the same there and here. But the man of the people has plenty of spirit, and even physically, quite a different bearing. Compare that man with the parade ground fascist who people the embassy. Why, it's like in Germany with our diplomats from the Wilhelmstrasse. Excuse me, Huell.
No, Huell is at the table, and Huell is a diplomat.
Yeah.
Huell is from the Foreign Service. I think he's there as an aide to, he's assistant to Ribbentrop or something like that. But
yeah, good point.
So he's apologizing to Huell, and it's Wilhelmstrasse, not Strasse.
Okay.
Have to remember that.
All these people are intolerable, deceivers, hypocrites, liars. I've never seen anything worse than those courtiers at Naples. As for the bodyguard they so kindly gave me, what foul creatures, what gallows birds. The fascists and the others, they're really two worlds in watertight compartments. The fascists call the courtiers lobsters because of their red livery. I was greeted at the station by the Duke of Pistoia, a real degenerate. Beside him was another duke, no less degenerate. There was an admiral there who looked like a court toad, a bogus coin, a liar. Happily, there was also a group of fascists. All of them, even Ciano, spoke with the deepest contempt of this ridiculous masquerade. During my excursions with the Duce, my breath was taken away by the skill and audacity of the motorcyclists who escorted us. What a handsome race.
I'm going to break in here for a second.
Yeah.
Because I want to give a little background. I think it's so understandable to be impressed by what he was impressed by, like these motorcyclists. I was looking at some pictures today. And there's a picture of his motorcade there with in the open car, and these motorcyclists were, you know, on the side of the car, in front of the car, behind it, and so on. And I guess they were quite handsome. All the men in Italy appear to be handsome. and they well built and everything, and they probably were very skilled on their motorcycles, and
sure.
And it's just a great feeling to see that kind of expression of power. Well, it's an expression of power, but also expression of pride in the country, and that you're in good hands and so on. But anyway, in 1934, Hitler's talking about his trip to Italy. And he went for a state visit in 1934, but it was just 2 days, and he went to Venice and met Mussolini. But he visited Italy again in 1938, and this time he went for a whole week, which is pretty long for him, from 3rd until the 10th of May, and he traveled to Rome by train. He didn't fly. And in Rome, the King of Italy and Mussolini met him at the station, and of course he was treated royally the whole time, and this is where he got to see all the famous architectural sites and so on of in Italy. He spent his time in Rome and in Florence and in Naples, and so that's what he discusses here. And he watched military parades and, you know, did all the sightseeing, which he never stopped talking about. He was very, very impressed with what he saw in Italy. So,
when I went out with the court, I was perched on a badly slung carnival carriage, which hobbled along in a lamentable fashion. The least depressing people there were the carabinieri who escorted us. "There's hope," the Duce said to me, "that in 50 years' time the court will discover the internal combustion engine." The officer's corps belongs to this fossilized world. And that's what he meant a few sentences back when he said the Italian military, why don't they appear to be soldiers anymore? It's because they don't have the proper leadership. And so he says the officer's corps belongs to this fossilized world. The senior officers have no contact with the people. Zitzler told me he had a meal of 5 or 6 courses given by frontline officers. Meanwhile, the other ranks were supplied with a watery soup. I consider it scandalous that such a thing can happen in the middle of a war. It must either feed the soldier's hatred for his officers or make him indifferent to everything. Our own fellows say the Italian simple soldier is a man of goodwill, inclined to enthusiasm for any cause, and that one could get all one wanted out of him if he were well led. Perhaps the Duce came on the scene a year or two too early for his revolution. He probably should have let the Reds have their own way for a bit first. They'd have exterminated the aristocracy. The Duce would have become head of a republic. Thus the abscess would have been lanced.
Yes, you know, you noticed that when I said that they met Hitler at the train station, the King of Italy and Mussolini, whatever his title was, there was no king in Germany. Hitler
right.
was the head of everything, but he's talked about this in the past, how Mussolini is saddled with not only the church leadership, which he has to cooperate with, which is so strong in Italy, you know, the Pope and the Vatican and everything, plus this royal family house, which was very damaging finally at the end, you know,
mm-hmm.
helped bring him down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you know, he mentioned that march on Rome, and it was in 1922, and when Mussolini led the fascists to Rome, and it seemed like a civil war might erupt and whatever, and the king, Victor Emmanuel, he decided to accommodate rather than
right.
to risk a war, and he appointed Mussolini prime minister at that time. And so thus Mussolini got a position of power, but he had to exist within that web of these courtiers that are mentioned and mm-hmm. the worthless people in Hitler's eyes that he was describing just previously, and instead of, if the Reds had taken over, he says they would have eliminated that bunch, and then when the Duce took over, he would have been head of a republic.
Right.
When I was with Mussolini, the crowd shouted, "Duce, Duce, when I was with the king, it shouted, Führer, Führer. and what he's saying right there was, you know who was really respected in Italy by the main, mm-hmm. the populace. In Florence, I was alone with the Duce, and as I read in the eyes of the population, the respect and burning love they devoted to him. The common people gazed at him as though they'd have liked to eat him. Rome captivated me. At Naples, I was interested above all by the harbor. At the court, I was aware only of the hostile atmosphere. But at Florence, everything was quite different, simply because the court, that foreign body, wasn't there. I've retained a painful memory of a visit I paid to units of the fleet in the Bay of Naples. The little king didn't know where to look. Nobody paid him any attention. At table, I was surrounded only by courtiers. I'd rather have entertained myself with the marshals. During the parade at Rome, the front row was occupied by old nanny goats, dried up and enameled, and wearing outrageously low-necked dresses, what's more, with a crucifix hanging between their withered breasts. The generals were in the second row. Why display this come-down of the human race?
He's really getting carried away there. He's not leaving anything to your imagination.
That's right. At the palace in Venice, on the other hand, everything teemed with lovely girls. But they managed to apologize to me for the faux pas that had been committed. Some mannequins from a fashion house in Rome, I was told, had strayed into the audience. But anyway, the difficulty for the Duce is that he's made himself a sort of prisoner to this society and has thus, to some extent, betrayed his own men. In his place, I'd invite some lovely girls from the Campania to my receptions. The place overflows with them. It wouldn't occur to me to compete with the king on his own ground. I'd be beaten in advance. These misunderstandings arise because the situation is not clear. The poor Duce, I'm often sorry for him. All the affronts he has to swallow. I don't think I'd endure them. There's also the third power, the Vatican. Don't forget that. Why be surprised if our confidential letters are broadcast to the world a few days after being received? I'll never forget the gratitude we owe to Noske, Ebert, and Scheidemann for having rid us of such people. Their intentions weren't pure, and that's why they've been punished, but we've reaped all the profit.
Yeah. Well, that's the end of January, too.
Yeah,
and this
yeah.
Noske, Ebert, and Scheidemann are social democrats, naturally, who headed the government earlier and opposed the communists and did some good in supporting the German military. So he's saying, you know, they're not all bad and they did some good, but
yeah.
They didn't go far enough. They still wanted to support the status quo, I guess, a little bit too much. Well, anything more you want to say about that long section there?
No, I think we pretty much hashed that one out.
All righty, I think so too. So now I'm moving over to February here.
Okay.
And there's a timeline, two items. First one is pretty interesting. Vidkun Quisling becomes the Nazi-aligned minister-president of Norway. And then the other one is more about Rommel. His forces reach El Ghazala, Libya, near the border with Egypt. During a winter lull, he will remain there. I don't understand that whole battle, those battles in North Africa at all. Never did. Never have. I'm far from being a student of that part of the war, so... Somehow that part of the world doesn't interest me as much, you see. You know, I just can't get into it that
right.
much.
Right.
Okay.
You know, well, we're all familiar with that saying that one man's traitor or rebel is another man's hero, and that definitely fit Vidkun Quisling. You know, in fact, his very last name has become synonymous with traitor or treason.
Right. Right.
Which is totally Jewish-inspired and very unfortunate because having read a pretty good deal about him and his life and all, he was an extreme patriot for his people. He was standing up for what he believed was the wave of the future when he supported National Socialist Germany. And he knew he was risking all in doing that. But, you know, anyone who does something like that is naturally, when the history books are written, going to be portrayed as an evil, vile traitor. And that's very unfortunate. And since you mentioned his name there, I just wanted to throw that in.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I know that, you know, Quisling is synonymous with a horrible traitor, but and, of course, he's demonized so much, and you're just
that's
exactly right. That because he really was a good man, they have to demonize him all the more to make
that's
sure
right.
that people won't see anything good in him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on to the 1st of February, 1942, evening, special guest, Himmler. Amongst the men who became conspicuous during the events of 1918, I draw certain distinctions. Some of them, without having wished it, found themselves dragged into the revolution. Amongst these was first of all Noske, then Ebert, Scheidemann, Severing, and in Bavaria, Auer. In the struggle that set these men against us, I was merciless. It was only after our victory that I could say to them, I understand the motives that drove you on. Those who were truly base men were of the Catholic Center, meaning the Center Party. Specker, for example. Tortuous methods and lies. Brunig, utterly lacked character. And Treverinus was a bounder. I'm full of understanding for a worker who was hurled into a hostile world and quite naturally found himself exposed to the seductions of Marxism, but not for those swine of theoreticians like Hilferding and Kautsky. Braun was not the worst of them. In any case, he was quick to put water in his wine. Luppe at Nuremberg was not a bad mayor. As for Scharnagel, he was a baker from head to foot.
Yeah, I don't really understand what he's talking about there very much, but I guess it's not. There's no need to go look it all up. But obviously, he's coming out. He's sitting here remembering all these people who were his political opponents and talking
right.
about how bad they were. But particularly
dislikes
these people in the Catholic Party.
Oh yeah.
He thinks
yeah.
they're the worst lack character, worst of all.
Yeah.
Base.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, he just never lets up on these Christians, does he?
Yep. In Bavaria, men like Stutzel, Schweier, Koch, and others were not bribable, but this did not prevent them from being fundamentally base. Lurchenfeld and Lortz were just poor devils. Matt was more a fool than a knave. Several of them were descended from Mongols and Huns. Some of them succeeded in improving themselves in the following generation. I've been particularly correct towards my opponents. The minister who condemned me, I've made him my minister of justice. Amongst my prison guards, several have become chiefs of the SA. The director of my prison has risen in rank. The only one whose situation I've not improved is Schweier. On the contrary, I've suppressed his plurality of offices, for on top of his pension as minister, he used to receive 18,000 marks as administrator of Bavarian electricity. Social democracy of the time lacked only a leader. Its worst mistake was to persevere in a path condemned by the facts. I was pitiless to all who indulged in separatism, if only by way of warning, and to get it into everyone's head that in that sort of thing we have no time for jokes. But in a general way, I can say I've been full of moderation. My conversations with Nortz, the police president, were amusing. In 1923, 2 days before the 27th of January, he claimed the right to compel me to hold in a hall a meeting that I wanted to hold in the open air. He invoked the security of the state as an argument in support of his decision, and likewise the fact that he had not enough police forces to guarantee our safety. I retorted that we were capable of guaranteeing order by our own methods. Moreover, I claimed the right to hold a dozen meetings in succession, not just one. I added that if he opposed our decision, the blood that would be shed would be upon his head. Our haggling continued, and Nortz finally proposed that we should split the baby in two, 6 meetings instead of 12, held simultaneously in the circus and on the field of Mars in front of the circus, for I'd declared that the circus wasn't big enough to hold all my supporters. Finally, Nortz granted me my 12 meetings, but in the following form. We would hold simultaneously 6 times 2 meetings. For him, that made 6. For us, 12. I had another conflict with him concerning an individual whom the police maintained in our midst. The man was, in any case, ill-chosen, for he stank of the police spy at a radius of 100 meters. One day I was visited by a policeman who announced himself to me as an old comrade from the front. He said he was racked by remorse, for it was he who took down the spy's reports from dictation. I asked the comrade from the front to go on recording what the spy had to say, but on condition that he sent me a copy every time. In reality, the comrade in question was inspired quite simply by a desire for revenge, as I subsequently learned. He was the victim of our spy, who was cuckolding him. When I asked for the circus for our demonstration on the 1st of May, Nortz refused it to me on the pretext that his forces were not enough to ensure order and that my men continually provoked their adversaries. I leaped on the word provoke. My men, I said, but it's you who send us provocative agitators in plain clothes. It's your spies who urge my innocent lambs onto illegal acts. Nortz supposed I was exaggerating. When I insisted and offered him proofs, he sent for his colleague, Bernreuther. The latter, who was certainly well informed, tried to calm me down. It was only when I threatened them that I publish in my newspaper a replica of the reports in my possession that the affair was settled. An hour later, we had the authorization to hold our meeting. There had been talk of attempting a coup in agreement with the bourgeois parties. It was to take place here and there all over Germany, especially in Thuringia. I'd been well let down by the bourgeois over the business, which I remember as the finest of our mess-ups. But Nortz couldn't prevent our march on Oberweissenfeld. At 3 o'clock in the morning, after taking possession of our weapons, we occupied Oberweissenfeld according to plan. The hours passed, still nothing happened. Our bourgeois allies had stayed in their beds. Calm prevailed throughout Germany, whilst we awaited from all quarters the confirmation of the expected risings. At 6 o'clock, gangs of Reds gathered to meet us. I sent some men to provoke them, but they didn't react. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and the Reich still did not emerge from its stupor. And we were still there on the lookout, armed to the teeth. We had to make up our minds to go home. During the return march, we met a few inoffensive Reds, fellows who could be dispersed by a flourish of trumpets. We beat them up a little in the hope of getting a big row started, but it was no use. Everything was over when a trotting horse-drawn battery, which I hadn't sent for, arrived from Tolz. It unfolded like a flower right in the face of the police. I'd done well to swear never again to undertake anything in collaboration with the bourgeois. 3 days later, I was summoned to appear before the prosecutor general, a bloody man, to reply to the accusations of having endangered public security. I in no way infringed public order, I said, but an attempt was made to do so. Who says that? The law declares the fact of arming gangs. Who is speaking of gangs? My men are perfectly disciplined. As for my weapons, they were stored in the state arsenals. So you possess weapons? Of course. Are you not aware that the others possess them too? This inculpation had no consequences. In the circumstances, Stinglin and Earhart were sitting pretty. This was how I'd procured weapons. A certain Councillor Schaefer had a store of weapons at Dachau, and he offered to sell them to me. At that time, I made it a principle to leave weapons in the hands of the civic guards, reasoning that they would keep them in good condition as long as there was no question of using them, and that in case of need, they would ask nothing better than to hand them over to us so that we could take their place in the first rank. Nevertheless, I thought it opportune not to reject Schaeffer's proposal. I therefore went to Dachau with Göring. We had the impression we'd fallen into a bandit's lair. Their first concern was to ask us for the password. We were led into the presence of a woman. I remembered her, for this was the first time I saw a woman with her hair dressed like a boy's. She was surrounded by a gang of individuals with gallows birds' faces. This was Schaeffer's wife. We drove the bargain, although not without my warning them that they wouldn't see the color of my money until the weapons were in my possession. We also found on the airfield at Schlesheim thousands of rifles, mess tins, haversacks, and a pile of useless junk. But after it had been repaired, there would be enough to equip a regiment. I went to see Lassau and handed him all this material, urging him to take care of it, and telling him, moreover, that I would make no use of it except in the event of a showdown with communism. It was thus solemnly agreed that the material would remain in the hands of the Reichswehr as long as this eventuality did not arise. Amongst the mixed parcels, there were notably 17 guns of all calibers. I got my hands on the second parcel in particularly comic circumstances. Somebody had mysteriously rung me up on the telephone to ask me to take possession of the crates. I didn't waste time in having the whole bill of fare read out to tell me what it was all about. I thought to myself that there were crates going for the asking, and I told myself that it was at least worth the trouble of going to find out. Nevertheless, I asked my interlocutor's name. Voll, he said, that's V-O-L-L, the brother-in-law of the proprietor of the warehouse. I arrived at this warehouse, which was in the Landsberger Strasse, and sure enough, I found there 48 crates that had been deposited there in my name. Voll told me that they contained arms, and that it was impossible for him to keep them any longer, for there were numerous communists amongst his workers. He begged me to have the crates removed as soon as possible. I went first to see Röhm to ask him if he could put any trucks at my disposal. He replied that he couldn't do that immediately. I then applied to Zeller. He accepted, refusing any payment, but laying it down as a condition that he should share the booty with me. I agreed. When we were loading the trucks, up came Major Stefani. He claimed that the arms were his. They're in my name, I replied, and nobody will stop me from taking possession of them. 3 days later, Zeller told me that the aforesaid arms were from his own warehouse in the Franz Josef Strasse, from which they had been stolen. What are you complaining about? I said. Haven't you recovered half of them? There were arms practically everywhere in those days. In monasteries, on farms, amongst groups of civic guards, it was to the citizens' credit that they thus assembled arms that had been thrown away by soldiers returning, demoralized from the front, and that others had pillaged at the depots. That's a fascinating section right there to me because, of course, he's describing the very early days of the party and its attempts to establish itself. And particularly against his most deadly and strongest enemy was the Reds, the Communist Party, and the perilous things that went on. And you know, even when he says, like, he was asking Röhm for help to move all those crates, and Röhm says, well, I'd like to, but I can't. I don't have any trucks at my disposal. So it wasn't like every time that Hitler needed something, it was there. It's showing the struggle that went on back then and the depth of that fight and the treachery that went on and the betrayal.
Yeah, and how he and his a matching of wits, how much he had to keep his wits about him, and yes. And he and not show weakness, but he always wanted yes. to show strength. He's kind of telling it, you know, I'm sure he's telling it the way it was. Of course, he makes himself look good, but it's, you know, he the thing is that for so many years, he did so much and so well, and what nobody else could do. And on through, up until the time we're in now, 1942, when the war is going, starting to turn, and all these countries are against him, and everything is against him. And then, you know, it became more difficult to always do the right thing, because it was very complex. And so there's probably some room for criticism. But, yeah, what I was reading about that, what Galland had to say today, and I want to get his memoir, and because I think he probably tells it pretty much the way it was from his point of view, as far as the Luftwaffe went. And so I definitely want to get that. But thinking how all that time Hitler did what almost nobody could do. He did so well, and that he made some mistakes. If he made some mistakes at the end, and the stress was so high, and you know, so much emotion going on, and so much going on that, nobody's gonna, you know, nobody's a perfect machine forever. You know, you wear down. Right. It's too bad. Maybe some. I don't think, though, that anything could have helped. I mean, some battles might have gone better. There's also the thing about the traitors, which is another issue we're not going to go into.
Right.
He probably doesn't ever talk about that in this book. He might.
Right.
I don't know.
But, you know, back into this, what we just read there, those early days, and they would try to set him up. They would try to bait him into things, and he had such a shrewd mind. And also the way he would handle things when they tried to spring their trap. They called him down there, said, come get these crates, they're in your name. He goes down and gets a gang together. They start moving these things out. Then this major, Stefani, comes over and says, hey, these are mine. I think an average person facing a minister of the state at that time would have backed off because, okay, you know, well, I didn't know they were yours and whatever. But Hitler jumped right back in his face and said, no, they're in my name, and nobody will stop me from taking possession of them. And just showing that kind of guts right there when he was walking a very, very thin line, and he wasn't really strong enough at that point to actually do things, but because of his tenacity and his actual bluff and his reading the character of his opposition, he was successful, and it set the groundwork for the future when he had to deal with these diplomats from other countries and things like this over negotiations. And of course he's always been, they've always talked about.
Yeah, he got used to calling their bluff, you know.
Yes,
he was good at that. That's basically what he was doing.
That's exactly what
he did.
And
it usually worked out well for him.
Yeah. So,
'cause there is a lot of bluff going on, so.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah. And it's interesting to me that, you know, going through school and reading so much and about all this, how so many of the writers, establishment writers, historians so-called, would say things like, if only these politicians back then would have stood up to Hitler's bluff, you know, if they would have called his bluff, this stuff would have never happened, whatever. And when in actuality, Hitler's bluff was a defensive bluff to what had already been put upon him. And what he did, you know, I mean, they dared to raise the ante, and he upped that. He raised them back, and it knocked them back on their heels. So, anyway, but that's, you know, that's primarily what that was about in the early days of the party.
Okay, so we got a timeline for the next section on February 2nd. It was General Joseph Vinegar Joe Stilwell, his name, Chief of Staff to Chiang Kai-shek, and Commander-in-Chief of the Allied Forces in China. So American general is Chief of Staff to Chiang Kai-shek. So I guess Chiang Kai-shek was totally under the American
control. Was very anti-communist. And he's the one that led the fight against Mao Zedong, you know, when they
you got the Americans running him.
That's right.
Hands of the Americans, and they're allied with Stalin. So
that's right.
But that's how that worked out. That's how that was working. All right.
Okay, I think we got time to do this last section.
I hope so. We'll just do it.
Yeah, we'll just do it. Okay, the 2nd of February, 1942, midday. Churchill is like an animal at bay. He must be seeing snares everywhere. Even if Parliament gives him increased powers, his reasons for being mistrustful still exist. He's in the same situation as Robespierre on the eve of his fall. Nothing but praise was addressed to the virtuous citizen when suddenly the situation was reversed. Churchill has no more supporters. Singapore has become a symbol to the entire world. Before 1914, it was only a commercial harbor. It was between the two wars that Singapore began its great rise and acquired the strategic importance that it's recognized to have today. When one builds a citadel like Singapore, it must be made an impregnable position, else it's a waste of money. The English have lived on the idea of an invincibility whose image is invoked for them by the magic names of Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Suddenly, they have to sink smaller and realize that this magnificent facade was merely a bluff. I agree, it's a terrible blow for the English. I've been told that an English statesman left a will in which he reminded his compatriots of the following sacred truth, that the only danger to England was Germany. François Poncet did not want the war. The reports dating from the end of his mission to Berlin are worthless in my view. The little vulgarities in which he indulged at my expense had no other object but to prove to his compatriots that he wasn't contaminated by us. If he'd had said in his reports that what he really thought, he'd have been recalled at once. In all his reports, he insisted on the necessity of following the evolution of the situation in Germany with close attention. Poncet is the most intelligent of the diplomats I've known, including the German ones, of course. I'd not have risked discussing German literature with him, for I'd have been put out of countenance. When he said goodbye to me at the Gralsberg, he was very much moved. He told me he'd done everything humanly possible, but that in Paris he was regarded as a man won over to our cause. The French are very clever people, he added. There's not a Frenchman who doesn't believe that in my place he would do much better than I. François Poncet speaks absolutely perfect German. He once made a speech at Nuremberg that began, "Now that I've had conferred upon me the dignity of an orator of the National Socialist Party, I've forgiven him all his remarks about me. If I meet him, I shall confine myself to saying to him, it's dangerous to give one's opinion in writing on people whom one does not entirely know. It's better to do it viva voce." Our difficulties on the subject of Morocco were smoothed out by him in 2 days. Henderson and Poncet certainly both had connections in industry. Henderson, for his part, was interested in seeing to it that war should come.
Now, Henderson was his British counterpart, British ambassador to Germany. So,
Poncet was the proprietor of some factories in Lorraine. But tell me, do you know a diplomat who poked his nose into everything as he did, who was connected with everybody and knew everything? Nothing escaped him. What didn't he distribute, like sweets? A supplementary attraction of his was his wife. What natural behavior. She hadn't the slightest affectation. Truly an exceptional woman. One day there was a dramatic incident. A foreign statesman passing through Berlin paid François Poncet a visit. It was the hour when children were leaving school. The children rushed into the drawing room shouting, "Heil Hitler!" When he told me the story, Poncet appealed to me. It was very embarrassing for me. Put yourself in my place. Soon afterward, Francis Poncet went to Paris and returned to Berlin without his children. I asked him if his children weren't happy in Berlin. "Young people are easily influenced," he said. "Just think, my children don't know who is the President of the Republic. I'm aghast. The other day we were passing a monument in Paris and suddenly they exclaimed, 'Look, Daddy, there's Bismarck.' I decided to send them to a good school in France." And that's an amusing little story there about that French diplomat and his own children coming in the room there when he had visitors hollering, "Heil Hitler." So
they picked that up
anyway,
at school, I guess.
Yeah. In my opinion, the man most guilty of all is Churchill. Then Belisha, Vansittart, and a swarm of others. The French let themselves be dragged in.
This Belisha is whore Belisha again. We've talked about him so many times. Hitler really doesn't like him. Sees him as one of the worst of these British. And he was Jewish, too.
Yes, that's right. The French let themselves be dragged in. In a general way, they supposed that Germany was about to collapse immediately. The Polish ambassador, Lipsky, had the cheek to write in a report that he knew from a sure source that Germany could hold out only for a week. People like that bear a great share of responsibility for what has happened. Lipsky, particularly, used to frequent the Dirksen's receptions. If a man like Lipsky could believe such a thing, a man who was present at all the party demonstrations, what can the other diplomats have written? I attach absolutely no value to what these people say. Each time he changes his post, the diplomat begins by paying his formal visits in the city where he's now residing. He exchanges conventional remarks with all and sundry. He has fulfilled the essential part of his mission. After that, he moves in a closed world with no windows open on the outside, and knows nothing of what is happening in this country except through the tittle-tattle of a barber, a manicurist, or a chauffeur. But these latter, by dint of living in the narrow circle of their clientele, have themselves lost contact with the people. In any case, they're cunning enough to tell tedentious old wives' tales if they think it appropriate. The less these diplomats know, the more they talk. They've nothing to do, and it would never occur to any of them to profit by his leisure to learn something. François Poncet is the only one I knew who used to run about continually, taking an interest in everything, to the point even of sometimes embarrassing me a little. Besides the big mandarins, one usually has to deal with agents of the needy, sponging types. They're timid, scared, always groping to know whether they should or should not pass on certain information. At the slightest slip or indiscretion, they might lose their jobs, be switched on to a sidetrack. In many cases, it seems to me it would be better to replace them by more modest representatives who would confine themselves to receiving and sending dispatches. Of what use were our own diplomats to us? What did they teach us before the First World War? Nothing. During the First World War, nothing. After the First World War, nothing. I suppose that for the others, it must be very much the same. Diplomacy should be reorganized from top to bottom. Take the case of the Far East. What useful information did I get from our services? A man like Colin Ross, for example, gave me infinitely more precious information on the subject. And yet Kriebel, whom we had out there, was one of our men. It was he who wrote to me that the Japanese were not nearly strong enough to settle with the Chinese. I recalled him, and he tried to justify himself in my eyes by insisting, "But it's what everyone was saying in Shanghai." That kind of thing is obviously explained by the company he kept, all of the same kidney, as is usual amongst diplomats. Colin Ross, on the other hand, saw all kinds. His view was that the Japanese would win the war, but that in the long run they'd be absorbed by the Chinese. I'm speaking now only of the diplomats of the classic sort. Amongst these, I admit only two exceptions, François Poncet and Bouchard, the only ones who ruled the roost. Men like Abetz will always be regarded as amateurs by the careerists. The Dutch representative was a man who knew what he was about. He worked hard, and he gave his government valuable information. The Belgian, he was a dwarf. As for the Swiss, he did his daily dozen, sent a report every day. To say what? God preserve me from such bureaucrats. I rack my brains wondering how to improve our diplomacy. On the one hand, one would like to keep men for a long time at the same post so that the experience they acquire may be of use to them, knowledge of the language and of local customs. On the other hand, one would like to prevent them from sinking into a rut. What is one to do? Probably the English have the best system. Besides their official representatives, they have a great number of spies. It would be very useful to me at this moment, for example, to be informed concerning the importance of the opposition in England, to know who belongs to it. As it is, all I know on this subject is what I've learned by reading the newspapers. Besides, can't I learn from my diplomats what Washington has in store?
That's excellent.
Yes,
it is. Because, you know, the German diplomatic corps really was not doing its job. And,
it
you know,
embassies
and other diplomatic posts like that, they're supposed to be picking up information. They're actually supposed to be spy centers, you know. And that's your entry into that other country. And they were sure doing it in Germany, the opposition, and being very successful. But the Germans weren't. And I think partly, I wouldn't blame, what's his name now? I can't think of his name. Ribbentrop. But I do blame, we can blame that horrible guy in charge of the intelligence services. You know that he's got a well-known name. Now, see, if it's not written down here, I can't. Can you think of who I'm talking about?
I can't think of it right now.
Well, he certainly was. He was a traitor himself, and the whole system was full of traitors. And Hitler should have done more. He should have been concerned, and probably he should have done more than just sit here and complain about it. I don't know if he did, but that's a whole interesting area. Well, we've got to go. We did very well with our time, just exactly right. So we'll say goodnight, right, Ray? And thank everybody for listening.
Absolutely.
All right. See everyone next week. Good night.
Good night, folks.